While on a routine sailing trip on December 4th, 1872, the Canadian ship De Gratia happened upon a ship without a crew in the Atlantic Ocean near the Azores. Upon investigating it, they found that the crew was nowhere to be found and the vessel's lifeboat was missing. Further inspection discovered that the captain and crew's personal effects were still there. Plenty of provisions were made, and a cargo of alcohol was largely intact. Searching the ship's logs revealed the last transcription had occurred on November 25th, but left no clear indicators as to the fate of the crew of the now derelict Mary Celeste. What happened to this lost crew? How can an entire ship be left intact without any clear sign of foul play? Were they waylaid by pirates, victims of a mutiny, attacked by some unknown supernatural extraterrestrial forces, or something else? Here we have one of the most compelling mysteries of history and a complete disappearance of the crew and passengers of the Mary Celeste, which we will be discussing tonight on Friday Night Fries. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, of Systematic Ecology, here to terrify and instruct you all of the weird, unusual, fascinating, fantastical, and unexplainable things that may or may not be lurking out there in the world. I am joined once again by my good co-host, Joe Day. How's it going, Joe?
And good to be here talking about some spooky nonsense.
Absolutely, my friend. Yeah. So you may notice there was a schedule slip again. Who was the cause of that? Oh, yeah, me again. It's allergy season. I was dead when we were going to record it a while back. I mean, Joe wasn't feeling that great either, I'm guessing, from how we talked about our allergies every year. Yeah, I was basically useless, bedridden. It was awful. I'm better, but yeah. It's still allergy season. So just as a reminder, our schedule is to, allegedly, once again, once a month, cover one of six categories. You have cryptozoology to paranormal, religious strangeness to weird and the unexplained, which we're doing this month, true crime and ufology. We're also in podcast form. So if you want to head that way and leave us, I don't know, 5 stars, wherever things work down there, do that. That'd be great. Otherwise, we have our initial YouTube broadcast we always do, so feel free to say stuff in the comments below. Like, we'd love to hear what you have to say both during the stream and after the stream. Also, as well, this is completely and utterly unedited. Joe has his own life outside of this. I don't know how to edit, so you know what, whatever we say, what that just happens to be there, so that's what you get. So Joe, when it comes to the Mary Celeste, do you have a history exploring this topic in particular?
Yeah, so it's twofold. One, I am of the vintage where Robert Stack was a voice that haunted the airwaves for my generation. And for those of you that have no idea what I just said, Unsolved Mysteries. There's a pretty famous segment on this for Unsolved Mysteries. And when in the era that I was coming up in the paranormal world, doing conventions and doing speaking tours in the whole nine yards, you could not go more than 5 feet on a convention floor without running into somebody that had some kind of book about the Mary Celeste. It's just one of those stories that hovers around the strange and the unexplainable. And honestly, if you don't see us on a Friday night where we are supposed to be streaming, just assume we got abducted by aliens. Either that or we're chilling with Bigfoot, one of the two.
Yeah, it's finally convinced Joe of the, you know, actual belief in both. You know what? And I'll take that win. If that's what it takes. We both get abducted by either Bigfoot or aliens. You know what? That's a win in my books. So when it comes to Mary Celeste, my introduction to this is something we'll actually be discussing briefly later on. In The Real Adventures of Johnny Quest, there is an episode where, you know, everyone except for, I think Jesse isn't in this episode, but the rest of the Quest team, I think, is there. And they're looking at these unexplainable, like, disappearances in this part of the Atlantic Ocean. And of course, they go into the legend of the Mary Celeste. So I learned about it from there. Since then, you know, different, you know, paranormal books being like, well, obviously ghosts were there, or obviously aliens were there, or we don't know. So I'm going to make up whatever fantastical thing I want to in order to justify you reading what I'm telling you to, you know, read right now. So I have spent many years with this, because I watched that episode when it aired, like 95, 96, around that era. So yeah, this has always kind of been a fascination to me.
Yeah, one of the things that you will learn about me is I wouldn't say that I've got a phobia or anything else like that, but I promise you, the last place that you are going to find me is out on the ocean, in a boat, out in the middle of nowhere, where if some nonsense pops off and Pazuzu decides to hop on board your ship, or some giant sea creature, or you do figure out that aliens or whatever other manner of nonsense is out. We're so worried about what's going on out in space, right? Like, we're so worried about aliens and extraterrestrials and all this other stuff. What about the area of the Earth that makes up a stunning majority? How about that? How about all the weird nonsense that's in our own waters? And I just no, I'm good. I would rather not be isolated out in the middle of nowhere, out on a ship. You couldn't pay me enough to be out there. So like, for me, hearing this story, like, it gets you know, you said it right. Everybody who's got their spin. You got somebody who's trying to convince you that aliens are real. Well, aliens abducted the entire crew of the Mary Celeste. You got somebody who's trying to tell you Bigfoot's real. Oh, Bigfoot jumped on board, and you know, before dining on the crew. You know what I mean? Like all this sort of stuff. Like, everybody's got their spin because of how unexplainable it really is. But like, here's the legitimate factor of it. Like, regardless of what you think, regardless of what spin you take and all of that, one of the supremely weird things for me is legitimately, we could throw around from the hardcore skeptic where it's all explainable and I don't want to have an ounce of fun because I don't like fun and I don't like theorizing about spooky nonsense and all of this sort of stuff, to the people who are just whacked out, right? Like, just fourth dimension, the Bermuda Triangle came out, Cthulhu came out and swallowed them whole, the whole nine yards. You can't explain any of it. You got nothing for a true to heart explanation. And out in the middle of nowhere, on what we will get into, known as like a doomed ship, that's like not just spitballing nonsense and all of that sort of stuff, like, do the historical facts, and it is wild and out. But like, seriously, kids, this is why. Come around to hear why you don't need to be going on cruises, you don't need to be going on sailboats, you don't need to be going out in the middle of the ocean. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's two things real quick. One, okay, maybe UFOs are not Joe's thing, but now he's all in USOs, so I can work with that. Two, I completely and utterly agree with you. I don't have a phobia of the sea or sea life or anything around there. I'm not Lovecraft. But you know what? I do have a healthy understanding and respect for what could happen to me out in the open ocean, which was why I would make a terrible sailor. It's just why some of the possible explanations for what happened here, I have one in particular that's kind of mine. And I go, because that's a thing that can happen in the world. And that terrifies me. So we'll get there when we get there. We've kind of talked about it a bit, but like, why do you think this story matters? Why do you think people are talking about it? 150 years later since it occurred?
Because legitimately, like, the best thing that you can do is provide a healthy hypothesis, right? Like, at best, you yes. can speculate. You legitimately, regardless of where you fall on the particulars, did it stay exactly on course? Did it go, 300 miles or whatever, wherever you land, you cannot negotiate your way out of, they're gone, never to be seen again. You got
sans bodies.
Nothing. Exactly.
Yeah, 100%. This is stuck around for so long. Yeah, yeah. You can say like pop culture, some of the stuff we'll talk later on, help, you know, keep it in the public consciousness. But it's the idea of people were on a boat and it happens however many hundreds of thousands of time a year. And yet this one ship, everyone's not there and we don't know why. Well, tell me why that happened. Like everyone else gets to make it, but not them. How could that? How?
Yeah, exactly. And that's where like you compare this to any of the, like the usual suspects for the strange and the unexplainable and all of this sort of stuff. There's something, right? Like there's some kind of hook. Maybe it could be this. There's some kind of hook. Maybe this is this and this is that. But even if, and this is kind of like, if I'm tipping a couple of cards out just so people can see kind of where I lean in all of that, like, okay, we can go like hyper reasonable and just go dry bones on this entire thing. Okay, so you mean to tell me like the world's most famous ghost ship and nobody steps forward and says I'm still alive? Nobody comes forward and is like, yeah, no, here's the tapes. Here's what happened. You get none of that.
All we have is speculation. And in the story, we'll see like probably the worst possible person who could have looked into this, as in like a very single-minded person. It is quite fascinating looking at it from that lens. So all those working against each other means we don't have an answer. And I don't know. You just want to get into this bad boy, Joe?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get into the history that we do know.
Okay. So the ship itself, the Mary Celeste, did not start off as the Mary Celeste. I had a couple initial crews before we get to our crew, our main protagonists of the story here, the mystery. The ship that would eventually be called the Mary Celeste was actually dubbed the Amazon after it was, you know, first created in 1860 in Nova Scotia. Later, it became seaworthy. I don't know why it took so long. I don't know shipbuilding. It's not my shtick. I just know they said 1860 and then 1861. Now it can float. Good for it. Its first captain was Robert McClellan, and he sailed in her initial voyage with a cargo of timber, until he died mid-voyage and was replaced by John Nutting Parker, don't laugh, who valiantly led the ship to England, where he forced them into fishing nets and accidentally sank a smaller ship when they ran into them. Like, we're almost at, like, King Tut's tomb nonsense, where people like to, like, correlate all the everything that happens there at the very beginning here. I don't personally buy into that, but like I could see why someone would say that given how this ship starts. So then Parker was succeeded by William Thompson. And from what I understand, we have very few logs of what happens in the in-between here. We're lucky to have the ones that we do, once again, because paper doesn't really last that long. We're lucky to have what we have. And apparently nothing of note happened until 1867, when the ship was forced ashore during a storm and left as a wreck until several days later. A gentleman named Alexander McBean claimed salvage rights, which is something you can do on the ocean, open ocean. I don't pretend to understand how that works. I just know it does. And because she was a derelict, and he sold the wreck to Richard W. Haynes, who was an American who restored the ship. And he is the one who has renamed her the Mary Celeste. Now, unfortunately for him, Haynes would lose the ship because he had a lot of credit debt, and it exchanged hands to financier James H. Winchester, who becomes kind of more important to this story. And its history at this time is largely unknown, except that it was later retrofitted and given to a Captain Benjamin Spooner Briggs, who becomes kind of essentially our main protagonist for this story, even though he doesn't have much to say after a certain point in time. And he bought about 4 shares of the ship. I believe there was 12 shares total in how this worked. And he recruited a new crew to make the vessel worthy of trading overseas again. Anything you want to add, Joe?
Yeah, no, I mean, before you even get to the meat and potatoes of it, like, I'm glad that you made the connection or the correlation between, like, there are one of the many, many things that hover around this is that this is a cursed ship, because
yes,
you have a series of legitimate unfortunate events. You have a whole preponderance of backstory that takes place before, like, you even end up at the point where you're actually telling, like, the meat and potatoes, the heart and soul of the story.
And I say this as someone who does believe in curses. Like, I do, based on more evidence than is here. Like, if there was, I don't know, maybe even the bare semblance of a folklore story of they, you know, made this wizard or witch upset and they cursed the boat, whatever. Sure, I could maybe go that way more, but there's like nothing in the story presented as such that leads me to believe there was someone outside the influence of the ship that put a curse upon it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I believe that there are bigger things in the spiritual world than just angels and demons. And so I am inclined to believe in legitimate curses. That being said, out of all of the spooky nonsense, it's just not there. Like, I just don't, like, if we saw something, I would be like, okay, like, cool. I don't, I'm not gonna necessarily deny it, especially because, like, of all of the nonsense and all of that, but that's just not something that we see outlined.
And we'll see later on that the story takes on a lot of extra history, and I use history in air quotes there, as far as what people actually believe, because, you know, things were reported falsely in one newspaper, or they thought they were reporting the truth in one newspaper, and that got spread somewhere. Other and we'll get short stories that come in that like fictionalize everything essentially, except for the fact that there was a ship named the Mary Celeste where the crew went missing, and that gets into public consciousness and ruins people's perception of this for many years to come. It's only with later scholarship that we can say, okay, this is why that happened. Let's like debunk that part of the story. Let's get into the real nitty-gritty here, into the missing crew themselves. Now, Captain Briggs, his job was to, you know, organize his ship as a trading vessel, and he did so by, you know, bringing some alcohol. I believe there was 1,701 barrels of it, so that they could trade with Genoa, Italy, get something from there, bring it back after, you know, selling it off. And in so doing, it was very common for married men of the time to bring, you know, their wives and children there, but he brought his wife Sarah Elizabeth Cobb and his baby girl Sophia, and left his son Arthur, who was just a couple years older, if I'm remembering correctly, behind with the boy's grandmother. So once again, very common practice because he's gonna be gone for several months at a time. He loves his family, wants to keep him with him, and from what I understand too, he was also a man of faith. He was noted to have read his Bible multiple times over, even in one day. Which, hey, great, love it on that. Whether or not he actually is, who can say? I only know about me. So, in addition, there we had the first mate, whose name was Albert G. Richardson. He was related to Winchester, the financier from earlier, by marrying into the family, by marrying his niece, and had previous working experience with Briggs. So they had gotten along previously. This will be important for later on. The rest of the crew as well was either recommended by Winchester or had previous experience sailing across the world, and were noted as being very peaceable and excellent sailors, unlikely to cause problems. Now, that in and of itself doesn't excuse anything that could happen later on, but it does bring a good foundation for what can happen later on. Now, Briggs himself noted in a letter he sent prior to traveling that he was very satisfied with his crew's qualifications and competency, and his wife likewise noted her appreciation for their demeanor. Anything, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the many things that hovers around this is that there was unscrupulous activity that explains the whole thing. And the problem with that is, and it kind of builds the case for where I think this where I think this does land. Like piece by piece, I think the case builds itself. One of the realities is you have to keep track of the pieces that you do know, right? Like that's one of the worst parts of the scholarship that's taken place around this topic because yeah, it's fun. It's fun to speculate. We all grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries and all of that sort of jazz. But that's the best outcome comes from finding the weird in authentic scholarship and
Yes.
authentic academics and all of that. And if the weird still exists, then it has a leg to stand on. Then you can it's got some support behind it. But if you're just saying a whole bunch of stuff based around stereotypes or things like that of sailors and things like that, and just ignoring the reality of the facts that you do have, well, then you've just made up a fantasy story. And
Yes.
you know, we'll get to how this plays out in explanations, but the truth of the matter is the crew, at least on paper, as best we can know, as best we can we can know from history and all of that, seems to be above board. Like the captain, like you said, seems to be a God-fearing man of faith, you know, as is somebody that it gets into some of the weirdness where you talk about like he would read his Bible to look for answers to some of the problems that he was going through and things like that, which slight PSA, don't treat your Bible like a magic eight ball. Just don't do it. It's not a good way to approach the Bible, but that's another conversation.
Yes.
But the reality is by public opinion from people who spoke into it, these people seem to be above board.
And that doesn't discredit the idea of a potential mutiny down the way, because, sociopaths exist. They're able to play into people and pretend to be what they're not. Sure, I could believe that too. But like, given the evidence presented to me, that seems less likely, before, we get to the actual end there. But we're not going to speculate on that actual answer yet. Moving on to the initial voyage itself. Like I said earlier, it was carrying 1,701 barrels of alcohol, and was initially loaded on October 20th, 1872, and was going to leave a little earlier, but it took some time for Briggs's wife and child to arrive. So he didn't order the ship to depart for Genoa from New York City on November 5th. Quite the time to wait, but you know what? Waiting for a wife and child, probably the best play there. Don't want to cause any problems there later on when you come back, if you do. So unfortunately, practically immediately, due to stormy weather, the ship was forced to stay in Staten Island for several days. My condolences to them. While at that same time, the De Gratia was preparing to leave as well. And when they did, they themselves had an 8-day journey behind the Mary Celeste when they had actually departed. So that is important for future reference as well. So they had actually, I mean, you can call it a synchronicity if you want to, but they had actually supposedly interacted with each other beforehand. The captains may have dined together, depending on some reports. But regardless, we know that they left 8 days before the De Gratia. So we anything you want to add before we go to the discovery of the derelict ship? Okay. So when we get to the actual discovery itself, as mentioned earlier in the prologue there, they sighted the Mary Celeste adrift at, excuse me, at 1 p.m. on December 4th, 1872, several miles away from the Azore Islands. You don't know where those are. Geography lesson. Islands off of the coast of Africa, a little that direction there. It's where you also get to Canary Islands too. They quickly realized it was without a crew when they saw how erratically that it was traveling. Like, sailors know how a ship is supposed to work. So they recognized immediately something's got to give there, and they boarded it to inspect what had happened, especially when no one responded, to any of their signals. They noticed that the sails of the ship were up, but in poor condition, and the rigging was damaged, but not unsalvageable. So it didn't seem like it had been like a cannonball had gone through it or anything, or someone had slashed it with a sword. It just seemed like something had damaged it, but they couldn't exactly tell what. and it didn't look deliberate to them at that point in time. They also noticed that for the ship, the lifeboat was missing, and there was about 4 feet of water in the ship's hold, which, from what I understand from the research I did, would have been like, okay, but certainly would have been like, okay, someone should be down here doing something about this. It's not going to sink the ship because the ship is going to get water in it. It's kind of just one of those inevitabilities that occur when you're traveling in the ocean, especially on these rickety wooden ships. God bless them. So they noticed that for it to have accumulated this much, the crew couldn't have been gone terribly long from when they discovered it, but it was also long enough for it to be an issue without being a problem. Now, in the ship's logs themselves, they had been written in until, like I said earlier, November 25th. And from the writing they had there, they gave no indications of fear of being attacked by pirates or a crew mutinying or anything like that. There was no trepidation by the captain he was writing down. And his effects and most of the crew's effects were largely untouched and inside their quarters. No signs of forced entry anywhere. There was some, goodness gracious, some not cabins. What's the thing to get down to a lower deck? What do you call that thing? Goodness gracious. Bunks. Yeah. Getting down that way, it looked like some of them were open kind of in a haphazard fashion, but that was about it. There were also no signs of any prepared meals laying around. There was no flies or anything circling around them. There were plenty of provisions left inside the galley, which would be really mysterious if someone had abandoned ship. They saw no signs of a fire that would have leaked, from the alcohol being around in an area like that. Could have caused a spark some way. They didn't see anything there. And they also noticed no indications of violence and assumed the crew had, for reasons unknown, decided to abandon ship. Now, Captain Morehouse, who is the captain of the De Gratia, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, I've said it multiple times, decided to bring both ships to Gibraltar by putting some of his crew on the Mary Celeste, and they kind of like tag teamed it together to end up there because, once again, salvage rights, no one's there on the ship. What? He's going to make a killing, is what should have happened, in an ideal world there. And arrived in Gibraltar in December 12th. He did so because, obviously being from Canada, you want to go to the British, and the British do own Gibraltar in Spain, right in that region of the world. And it was there that the Mary Celeste was impounded, and an inquiry was formed to discover what truly happened. Do you want to go about anything before we get into the inquiry itself, Joe?
No, good.
Okay. So in the initial inquiries, they were undertaken by multiple men, but the main, our main antagonist in this story is Attorney General Frederick Solly Flood. Who was noted by many people around him for his bullheadedness and singular focused thinking. And I mean, if he had an idea, that was the idea. Nothing's going to dissuade him from it. That's never once happened to me. I could never say that about me. He began the investigation believing that there was some criminal action that had occurred due to the possible smuggling of alcohol and barely allowed any other evidence. The idea being is that, there was either collusion between the two captains and maybe there was a fight between them and he killed the original crew so that they could get more money by salvage rights and selling off of the alcohol, or they had dropped them off on the Azores or the Canary Islands or something like that before they got to Gibraltar. And then they were going to come back and give them their split of the cash. That was Flood's idea. So he'd been had major investigations on the ship. Some of it done by a diver and as well as a ship surveyor, who both found, cuts on the bow that seemed to indicate some possible violence that occurred, as well as seeming traces of blood found on the captain's sheathed sword, which was in his office. And it looked initially like it had been unused until they discovered, this might be blood. They also saw several parts on the ship that looked like they might be blood. So that's that for that. So in his job there, Attorney General Flood accused Captain Morehouse of doctoring the ship's records, as he refused to believe that an uncrewed ship could have been at the location he described in his reports based on his understanding of navigation and the like it couldn't possibly have drifted this way. You would have had to have been behind it, was his idea, and continued to believe that he himself was involved in an alcohol smuggling ring without any proof. He believed that, once again, Morehouse, like I said earlier, was possibly in contact with Captain Briggs and that there was this grand conspiracy to either have his crew pretend to mutiny or actually mutiny, and he didn't have contact with Briggs. The idea being that something bad had to happen to the Mary Celeste so that they could get theirs. Now, then Winchester, you remember the financier, goodness gracious, English language, arrived in Gibraltar to settle the ship's account and regain what he saw as rightfully his cargo, and spoke in the defense of Captain Briggs, you know, calling him a righteous, Bible-believing man who had no history of wrongdoing, had never done anything against him. And he testified that Briggs would have only left the ship behind if there was no other option available to him. Now, in the midst of this inquiry, Flood was floored when forensic testing on the ship, I don't know what forensic testing is in 1872, but I guess it was good enough for this, showed that the captain's sword and other potential sites of spilt blood were shown to be another unknown substance. I looked this up to see if someone else had explained it. I don't know if you found something different, Joe. I don't know what they actually found, but it looked like blood, but it wasn't blood.
It's unsubstantiated exactly what it was.
Okay. Yeah. So Flood's single-mindedness was further destroyed by the reports of American consul Horatio Sprague, who kind of we had like ambassadors of a sort in Gibraltar with them. You know, given that trade would happen, we'd need someone around there to like to take care of ships if we weren't in the area. And Horatio testified that the cuts on the bow or bow were naturally made from expected sea travel. So, you know, you might end up accidentally going up against a rock or something, or, you know, just from the wear and tear, erosion of being out in the sea kind of degrades the material. And in his opinion, that's how it looked. So, unable to find further evidence for his case, Flood reluctantly returned the ship back to its owners, who, in a typical, yeah, a typical move, offered a pittance of the salvage to Morehouse and his crew that made everyone involved equally angry at each other and left no answers as to the whereabouts of the crew. So no one ends the story happy. We end the story not happy because we don't know what happened. Joe, what are you thinking?
So there are, in and around this part of the story is where you have different takes on some of the details. So depending on who you ask, the boat traveled off like 300 and some odd miles off course. Other people you ask, it had stayed exactly on course. You have some people who will say that there's evidence that up until the morning of like there's the last morning that you have writings in the log that are like partially incomplete. The alcohol is part of what I hear a lot for people who don't like fun. Where the alcohol, for those of you that don't know, if not properly vented, will create very dangerous fumes. And if contained in a certain area, will actually expand out the area that it's in. And there's speculation that there was bad weather, and so they were unable to properly vent the area. And the reason why there was water in the bottom is that they vented it, but they couldn't risk, you know, a problem happening within the ship and the ship going up and the whole nine yards.
Yes.
A lot of speculation stacked on speculation there. Now, I'm not saying that colors outside of the lines, but I'm also saying that even if you go the driest possible route, you still don't have anything definitive.
Yes.
You still need to speculate about each one of the pieces. Now, unfortunately, history is also plagued with bad actors and people that, you know, you make allowances for the fact that we're talking about the 1800s, and we've talked about this with other cases where you cannot expect the same level of documentation and scrutiny and the whole nine yards. But on top of all of that, you also do have documentation of just incompetence. It's just people that are just incompetent as far as this goes. But even if you go so on top of the venting thing, the other thought that goes alongside that is that's why the lifeboat was gone, is that they had abandoned ship and that a storm knocked them off and that they couldn't get back to the ship, that the ship had sat abandoned, couldn't get back to it, et cetera, et cetera. Again, we are talking about a day and time where one of the prime forms of business happened on the high seas. You have people that, like, this was a huge way of commerce. It had to be. And so these are people that would have been very well versed in knowing how to get word back had they had survived, something along those lines.
Yes.
And I stand by the fact that if anybody would have survived this, we would have had some form of documentation that they resurfaced at some point. And so you have to, if you are going to authentically approach this story, deal with the fact that you can bring just as much, if not in certain ways, more scrutiny on the Occam's razor style approach to trying to bring a conclusion to the story as much as the weird and wild ones. And I'm saying when all things are equal, when we are in good faith, not, you know, just making stuff up and all of that.
Yes.
That's why I don't personally subscribe to it stayed on course. I just think that there's far too much evidence that's not what happened, that it went off of course and because it was derelict. But when all things are equal, to say that they abandoned ship and what, a storm got them and they didn't make it, that to me, I ask the question, okay, if there's no other form of, or no other indicator of an actual emergency, and you lose your cargo, dude, you're out. You got nothing. There's no form of insurance. There's no nothing. That's your livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
That whole crew is gonna get furious because their payday is contingent on getting from point A to point B. That's how these sailing ventures would work at this point in time. And so everybody, not just the captain, has invested interest in getting from point A to point B. And so some form of indication, some form of writing in the log or making some sort of effort to stay connected with this ship when everything else being equal, it didn't appear to have endured anything significant in that sort of way. Any kind of catastrophe, even a storm, like you said, the level of water at the bottom of the ship was there but not so significant that it was, you know, unsailable, or it was about to sink, or whatever the case may be. So, like, if you're talking about a, like, including in the tapestry of ideas that a storm took out the crew, then explain to me, please, why the ship doesn't seem to have had that, any sign of that at the same time. So while sure, there are, when you look at the full spectrum of possibility, non-spooky answers to the whole thing, those feel like some of the responses to this that require the most leaps of faith.
Yeah. And the truth of the matter is, there's no smoking gun here in the case. Like, I have my personal pet hypotheses. I'm sure Joe does too. Like, and there's going to be a hole in it. The hole in mine is actually what you just mentioned, of the state of the water inside of the ship. Meaning, like, why would they do what they do if I think what I think? And that's just, unfortunately, where we end up in this story. With, we simply don't know because they're not there to tell us the story. It, right. They're gone. That sans being around. Like they were there, then they're not. And you bring up a great point earlier about, you know, some people do think that it went on, maintained its course. I don't think a ship without a crew is going to do that. I think it's going to be more susceptible to the wind and the waves and go in a different direction, which kind of doesn't kill the idea, the De Gratia, being in collusion with people on board and wanting to, you know, grab it for themselves, because how would they know where they ended up in such a case? I mean, it boggles the mind. Did they travel the same route as them and go, wait, they're not there, and then go this way? Or were they going this way and they just happened to be upon them? Because as some people do record, it seems to have been about 300 miles off course when it is found.
Yeah. And the thing to remember is that at this point in human history, this would be tantamount to, like, should that of that level of fraud had taken place, okay, that would be tantamount to, you work for a financial institution and somebody has, you know, they bring in a sack of cash to get deposited, right? And you decide, oh, I'm going to get mine. So I'm going to take that sack of cash and I'm going to leave with it. And it's, I don't know, a million. We'll say 2 million. We'll say 5 million. That's fine. That's not enough money to get yourself blackballed. That's not enough money to live off of for one person, let alone an entire crew.
Yes.
An entire group of people. And your word, like, when you're talking about prime areas of shipping, to get blackballed as a pirate is a very significant thing. You would have a reputation at this point in time. If you resurfaced, and that the kind of money that we're talking about, just simply even for the time, would not have been enough of a payday to secure somebody for the rest of their life. And so going down the rabbit hole of any kind of fraud just doesn't make any sense, let alone the actual geography of it not making sense either.
Yeah. And at this point in history, it's not as if piracy has ever left the seven seas, as it were. There have always been, you know, pockets around the world. But you remember, you know, in the age, the golden age of piracy, what stops it is British naval forces, French naval forces, Spanish naval forces getting more active, locating exactly where they're going to go, protecting their vessels better, and killing anyone who got in their way. Yep. The next group who were like viable would be the Barbary pirates, who acted around North Africa for quite some time in the Mediterranean. Most people were willing to pay them off until the U.S. said, "Nah, we're good with that." Then we had the First and Second Barbary War, and it's not like they stopped being an association. We just stopped, like, "Hey, don't you dare target us." And then other nations started following suit. So they lost their sphere of influence. So it is possible for there to have been like a pirate-esque crew here, or people working in collusion with each other for insurance and the like, but it is not probable given the period of time we're in right here. All right. This is not the end of the story for the ship. Like, you know, we're going to tell the story of the Mary Celeste. We're going to tell the rest because there's some fascinating history here. So because of all the bad press, the ship was sold 2 years later in 1874 to several New York businessmen. She had very unsuccessful voyages, you know, to the Caribbean multiple times over, and eventually was just sold to some Boston merchants in 1880. About 4 years of mediocrity happened, and in 1884, it was now captained by a man known as Gilman C. Parker, who then became a part of an insurance conspiracy. So these actually happen. We have actual documents and the like that do prove something could happen here. And what the conspiracy was they were going to mislabel the cargo of the ship so that it appeared that they bought things that were more valuable than what they currently had on the ship. And what they were going to do is running aground. So at the time, this value of the value that we're making up would have been around $30,000 in this period of time, adjusted for inflation. God help us all, it would be $1,070,000 in today's money. So Parker's plan was to go through a notorious reef that was near their destination of Haiti and deliberately run the ship into the reef. His crew had prepared for this, they were all in on it, and fled on lifeboats with some cargo till they could look like, "Oh, we tried to get the cargo, guys, and it just happened to be this stuff that's not as expensive as the other stuff we said was on here," which they then sold for a pittance of its value, hoping that everyone would believe him. Like, "Oh, they tried, guys. They did their best, but unfortunately, it's all lost. We'll give them their money." But insurance agencies have a reason behind what they do. They insure things because they want to make money. And as part of wanting to make money, they're also going to investigate claims made when stuff is lost. So when you have a lot of people in a conspiracy, it's a lot harder to keep those secrets inside the conspiracy. Some people broke, they found the proper information and go, "Oh, you said this was here, but it actually wasn't. We're going to charge you for a fancy word." I learned a new word today, barratry, which is the willful destruction of ships for the purposes of gathering insurance or some other nefarious means there. Love that new word. So he goes to trial. He had two separate trials. The first trial, he had a jury who couldn't come to a decision based on the conspiracy charges because for some reason they were afraid if they convicted them here, he wouldn't look good and his character would be defamed for the second one. So like a reverse what happened to OJ, I suppose, where in a civil suit, like he lost, but in the big bad one, he didn't. Whatever. So the judge is like, "Okay, whatever. I'm going to make a deal with you people." And here's what's going to happen. We're going to drop charges and the insurance company is going to lower the rates and everything. You're going to get a little bit of paid, but your name is Mud. And that's exactly what happened to Parker. His name was Mud. His reputation was destroyed. As Joe mentioned earlier, you want to play pirate, people are going to call you pirate or fraud or what have you, and he died in poverty just 3 months later. So was it worth it all? Absolutely not. And I will say there was an attempt, someone believed that they had found the wreckage of the Mary Celeste in 2001. This proved to be something else entirely, so we don't exactly know where the ship is to this day.
Yeah, anything? There are museums in Europe, I think it was Norway, Scandinavia, I don't remember exactly, that claim to have pieces of the Mary Celeste. But as to the authenticity of it, it's debatable.
Yeah. All right. So we kind of talked about a couple of the potential answers here, but like, why don't we just go on systematically here? Like, the internal strife slash mutiny option. What do you think about that one?
No, there's just no evidence for it. Like you can speculate based off of the time, but it's no more than just saying, oh, hey, this is something that would happen at the time, and so we're not going to rule it out. And while you can say, okay, cool, I'm not going to rule this out, I just think I think it discredits and discounts a lot of the actual information that we do have about the people that are involved.
I can't get behind this one either. It is possible, once again, for a crew to be upset with the captain and his decision making, or maybe he disciplined one person and he got angry and he got a bunch of people riled up. That has happened historically multiple times over throughout naval history. But once again, looking into the profiles of the crew that we gained earlier, how the captain thought of them, the captain's demeanor as well, the fact that he has his wife and child on this very ship would lead me to think that he doesn't want to rock. Literally rock the boat, as it were, here and cause problems. And even then, let's say there is a mutiny. Okay. Where are they? Where'd
Right,
they go?
where's the evidence that there was a mutiny, even down to like even if no logs are left, where's the evidence on the ship? Where's the evidence, you know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
that all of that would have left proof text behind, and that's one of the things that detracts from this. The most for me is just there's no onboard evidence.
Yeah. And it's the same thing. Like, there's no signs of blood anywhere. What they thought was blood wasn't actually blood. The lifeboat is gone, sure, but like, why would you leave a perfectly seaworthy vessel behind and go in a rickety lifeboat when you're already on a rickety ship that at any moment could die thanks to a strong storm or what have you? Like, it makes no sense to me based on the evidence presented. So let's go with the insurance fraud idea. We've noted. It has happened historically with the Mary Celeste after the fact. Could it have happened right here and now?
I mean, in the grand tapestry, could it have? Maybe, but is it in any way, shape, or form a probable answer? Not even a little bit.
Yeah, once again, as mentioned earlier, when you have a conspiracy, the more people you have in on it, the more likely something's going to get leaked. That doesn't make conspiracies impossible if you have the right people who know when to shut up around. But if we take Flood's idea that the captain of the De Gratia was behind here, Morehouse, somehow getting either pirating from that ship and taking things over and saying that we don't know what happened, they weren't there when we got there, or working in collusion with the crew of the ship to make it look like something had happened to them and so that they could get salvage rights and get paid for it. I'm not seeing the evidence for either option here. From what I understand, it seems like he came there in good faith. It's like, look, this is how things work on the sea. I did everything I was supposed to do. No one was alive on the ship. This is now my ship. I can do whatever I want with it. And I'm giving it to you so you can prove this in a court of law. And now suddenly everyone thinks I'm a criminal.
Exactly.
All right. So there are two more natural hypotheses turn out here. The first one, I kind of put them together. That's the heavy storms slash waterspouts idea. Waterspouts being, especially in warmer weather environments, a kind of a mini, well, not mini, a very large, a sea tornado, as it were, that can cause and wreak devastation across on ships. And of course, heavy storms, this is the Atlantic, what, any ocean really. Seas happen, storms happen all the time. And we've lost countless hundreds of thousands, if not millions of sailors over the history of the world because the ship just fell apart because the storm was just that bad. So, like, what do you think, Joe, about this as a possible explanation.
You know, I think it lines right back with the other options that we've talked about. Like, in certain ways, I would call this more probable, especially if you incorporate in the whole alcohol thing. Sure, that it's slightly more probable than the other options that we've had, but you still don't see the evidence. The evidence is not there that this is the thing. Like, the truth is, there wasn't that much water in the actual ship, and it would have been an extreme overabundance of caution to leave the ship. And then, yeah, I mean, if there was more damage to the ship itself, it would make more sense. And I would say, yeah, sure, this probably makes the most amount of sense. Is it disqualified entirely? No, absolutely not. But again, I think you need to negotiate with speculation as much, if not more, than some of the other answers that are out there.
Yeah. I agree that this is more plausible than other ones. And the idea that it could be this giant storm just kind of happens. It's the Atlantic, is what it is. Or a waterspout came up and sucked people up. But what kind of kills this idea for me is the fact that the sails are in the state that they're in. Like, they're not pristine. They've taken some damage, but not like earth shattering. This is the easy explanation for what happened damage. And as well as the lack of water in the bottom of the ship, that if this were to happen, a huge storm were to happen, instead of like maybe what I'm thinking might have happened, I still don't have definitive proof for it, where one thing happened and everyone's gone. Like, it's harder for that to be an explanation, unless maybe one person was left behind and they couldn't take it anymore and they jumped off the ship later on after they had gotten all that water out, which, I mean, you're adding more answers to explain a potential explanation, which isn't of itself a bad idea. You have to speculate, but it's extra work I don't think needs to be put in there.
Right.
All right. This next one is my pet hypothesis. And once again, as I said, there are holes in it, as there are in all these. And that is the rogue wave. And I think why this appeals to me is because it appeals to my idea of never being on a boat in the middle of the ocean. And the fact that, if you don't know what a rogue wave is, it is exactly what it says on the tin. It is a wave that comes from nowhere with no indication that it's on the way, smashes into things, and then dissipates. It doesn't require a storm to happen, bad weather to happen. It's simply the way the tides work. This water was plucked up, went this way, and it happens with no like way to account for how it happens. So how I look at this, if this is the answer, which I'm not, once again, taking a bullet for this one, the idea is that this rogue wave happens. They have no time to prepare. Everyone's on the deck. Boom. Splashes them all off the ship. No one at that time really knew how to swim that well. They're gone. They're taken on the water and drowned. Maybe someone survives and goes into a lifeboat for a bit, and they think the ship might be sinking without any evidence, because we can still see that, like, there wasn't enough water down there in the bottom of the ship. But that's what I'm thinking. What do you think, Joe? Why am I crazy?
I mean, again, like the storm thing, I would say essentially the same thing here. Like, you're talking about a wave that would have had to get it in one. You're talking about one. You're talking about a wave that would have literally needed to take out an entire crew. Impossible? No. Likely? Absolutely not.
Yeah. And as we noted, I should have noted before, the crew was quite small considering the size of the vessel. So there weren't that many of them, but the idea of everyone being on the deck at the same time is a huge leap in logic. I will once again grant that too. Maybe it was the middle of the day and they were celebrating, or maybe it was night and they were about to feast. Who knows? Like, no one knows because we weren't there. Right. So next up on our docket, we have the giant squid hypothesis, Joe. Now, if you don't know your cryptozoology and actual biology, giant squids have been something that have been speculated about for millennia. As sailors have been across the sea, there have always been reports of giant squid out there. And it is more recently that we have actually discovered that such things actually exist out there in the wild. Not quite, you know, I can't remember some of the figures for the Kraken and the like. They're like however many feet long. I don't think we're that bad, but still enough to where it could be a potential threat. What do you think about a giant squid, Joe?
I'm going to go with no, but with the giant asterisk, the fact that there remains a possibility that you will run into a giant squid, again, do the research. Why would you do that to yourself? Like, let me go out on this boat that, like, if friggin' Cthulhu decides to come up from the deep, if somebody decided to release the Kraken, I'm gonna hang out on a ship. Like, no, you're screwed, dude. Like, stick your head in between your legs and kiss yourself goodbye. Like, that is, those are your option. Get screwed by a Kraken and like it. That's what you've got ahead of you. Like, that's it. And so, like, that to me is one of the most truly terrifying options, because, like, yeah, sure, a rogue wave, absolutely. That's, again, if I'm building my Mount Rushmore of reasons as to why I'm not going on a friggin' sailboat, that's one of them. But also, like, you don't know what lives under the ocean. Like, we want to worry about exploring the stars, explore the friggin' waters, understand what's sharing this planet with us, and then get back to me. You know what I mean?
Yes. So while I like this idea, I don't find it very plausible. In the idea, you know, a giant squid attacking a ship would leave multiple marks on the entire ship, and probably have brought it down with it if it attacked one vessel. And that's historically speaking, when there are mentions of a giant squid attacking a ship, you know, whether you're talking about Viking lore or what have you, like, it takes it down with it because it's a big squid and it's a small boat. Yeah, even a ship the size of the Mary Celeste, with what we have, of what we have actually studied with giant squids that exist in the world, I think it would still, if not go down, or at least be extremely battered after it got what it wanted from feasting on the crew, having found a taste for human flesh.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's it. Like, you look at the damage that was done to the ship itself. It just wasn't there. You know what I mean? Like, it was so minimal that it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So we kind of talked about pirate attack anymore. Anything you want to add to that, or just move on?
I just move on. I just don't think. Okay. I think that's kind of like the insurance fraud thing, where that's something that, like, it's not that it didn't happen. It's just that that sits more at the realm of stereotype.
Yeah. All right. So this final one, I'm kind of putting a lot of things together. Like, we have mass abduction by UFO. We have, you know, merman attack. We have USO encounters to ship. So, like, all that together, what are your thoughts on something more extra normal happening to explain why all the food's there, everything's kept in order, but the people are gone, Joe?
All right, let's get weird. So there is a running theory that moving bodies of water are areas that create a more susceptible atmosphere to interdimensional or spiritual activity, because it's an increase in energy in that space. And like this is long been since researched, like not even in science, but like also in like metaphysics and all of that. Like several different classifications of science have talked about this. And the reality is they're all gone. So again, either way, weird or not, you've got to negotiate your way around that one.
Yes.
Now, it that there I think sits a level that you cannot completely withdraw from the idea that there are pockets that exist within the ocean area that we have where all electromagnetic activity dies out or spikes in really weird ways where people have just gone and never come back. And to me, if you're looking at this with an open mind, the idea of an interdimensional slip is where I start to look at this and, like, okay, if I'm going to negotiate either way, this to me requires less negotiation than a natural event happening, a natural disaster, anything like that. And there are, especially from the area that we are talking about, several pockets that have been purported over the years to have these sorts of pockets of strange phenomena taking place. Now, I don't think they got abducted, and I don't think mermen or any of that sort of stuff. If anything, you're talking about an increase in frequency variation because of turbulence, because of water, because of the whole nine yards that could have slipped the whole crew into another dimension.
So how would you explain in that idea the ship being intact, but the people aren't? Is it just a frequency of human beings? Is just whatever this force is more attuned to, and that's what it's grabbing? Or like, not even assuming an
So
intelligence behind it.
it could be anything from the vibrational frequency to organic matter to like any of those variants in actual material makeup could have been the reason why one form of mass and energy would slip and another one wouldn't.
Okay. I can see it. Like, I mean, as much as we understand how these metaphysical things work, which we don't as much as we would like, we're still working on it. That sounds plausible enough that I can't discount it out of hand. Now, when it comes to the UFO thing, sure, it is once again possible. You know, if interstellar craft are able to traveling to great distances between worlds or through time or how heck or through wormholes and black holes to get here, sure, that could have happened. What makes this not as plausible to me in that idea is given most UFO, you know, contact or with either people or with the Earth itself, most cases have some trace of radiation left behind that it doesn't seem like anyone from the other ship was affected by. That doesn't discount it out of hand, but I'm going with like most cases, something's left behind is like extra normal in the fact that this radiation isn't normally here. And of course, they wouldn't have understood radiation at that time if they were to go through it because Madame Curie wouldn't come around and bring her theories about radium and like with her husband until what, 1903, if I'm remembering correctly.
I think so.
So, yeah. So possible, not plausible. The merman thing, I kind of threw that in there just because I thought it was funny. You know, because are mer people real? Well, depends on who you talk to. They're in pretty much every culture around the sea has some mythology around them. But the thought that they randomly attacked this one ship and not other ships across the history of the world kind of kills the credibility to me. Also, how would such a society develop without being able to utilize fire? Would they be sapient at all? Kind of hard to tell. Not, once again, disregarding it out of hand, but it, as them actually being a thing, maybe. But like for this, I see no evidence for mer people. Also, the same thing, no violence was shown in the ship. There were no claw marks, irregular claw marks or anything like that on the side of the ship that would indicate some foreign presence there. Someone also threw out the idea of some paranormal ghost thing happening here, and like the ghosts of the dead sailors, something compelled them to like commit mass suicide over the ship. It's like, okay, well, you can say that, but I mean, where's your evidence?
But so to that, within that same ballpark. Now, I'm not going to say that I necessarily agree with exactly what you just said, but again, in the theory, because all of this, like, if there's any one thing that you learn from us as we unpack these things, like, yeah, I'm not throwing out that it could be a rogue wave. It could be a storm. They could have gotten capsized and killed the whole crew, and it wasn't that big of a storm. It just was the wrong place at the wrong time. Sure. Cool. But there there isn't enough evidence to exclude the possibility, then keep an open mind. And so there is a theory that the more you seek out the spiritual, the more open and attractive you are to the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Now we are not necessarily a Christian broadcast. We are two Christians who do a broadcast. Those aren't the same thing.
Yes.
But being two Christians who do a broadcast means that there is likely a not zero amount of our audience that just threw a flag on the play because of what I just said, especially if you are in an area or of a vintage or whatever that is more influenced by the satanic panic in a post-satanic panic world. But for even my fellow brothers and sisters out there, take a second and extrapolate out the thought process and talk about some of the things that we will say about Christians who seem to be more in tune with the Holy Spirit. Now, I'm not putting the Holy Spirit on the same playing field as, let's say, an earthbound spirit or a forest spirit or a water spirit or whatever. But what I am saying is that if we're already opening the door to the supernatural, because like sometimes we lose sight of the fact that like we worship a dude who came back from the dead. Let's start the conversation there. And then we talk about like the Spirit of God inhabiting us. Like we are some of the spookiest bunch. We just don't like to talk about it because we get freaked out because of the satanic panic, because everything's a demon.
Yes.
But like if all things are equal, I'm not coloring out of the lines really at all to say that the more receptive you are to the spiritual, the more you're going to experience the spiritual. And so again, let's go back to the beginning of the conversation. The ship's captain is a holy man.
Yes.
Deeply devout. deeply spiritual. I'm just saying that when you add it up, and if you are willing to rest in the uncomfortable, then the door is not closed to this aspect of it. Now, again, like merfolk, like cryptids, like UFOs, all of that sort of jazz, like, if they're real, why don't we see them? Like, seriously, why is it that every single time we got a guy trying to avoid charges of being a pedophile that we're going to hear about UFOs? Like, just saying. But like, I'm not sitting here saying that they got taken up. I guess if I'm keeping my point of view in line, and we've talked about this before with other ufology topics, if we're talking about extra dimensional rather than extraterrestrial, then we have entered back into the realm of conversation that I would be more apt to play in. That being said, though, I think there are more things on heaven and earth than we could possibly wrap our mind around. And I think we have trained ourselves because of the entertainment side of the paranormal, the TV side of paranormal. Like, one of the things that one of the reasons why I keep coming back to this, and why I am a full-blown pastor doing this thing, is this is one of the few spaces where I can encourage deeper thought. And I can be open about the things that, like, okay, either I've experienced or I'm out of my friggin' mind. Either these things happened or I'm making it up, and I know I'm not making it up. So, like, there are things that exist that even if I'm talking down the camera to our brothers and sisters in the faith, the Bible doesn't say don't go screwing around in the dark because it's all fake. Don't mess around with this stuff because it's fake. That's not what the Bible says. Process it. Like think about it. And part of the problem is that so much of this sits at the level of the entertainment side of paranormal research that I just wish that more people would take seriously actually processing the realities of the paranormal, of the supernatural, all of that sort of jazz, and not be afraid that it's going to break your Bible in half, because it's not going to break your Bible in half to say that there's extra dimensional things. Do you really think that you go up high enough and you get to heaven? What do you think God is? Seriously, what do you think heaven is? It's another plane of existence, friends. Like, if you're talking about a literal heaven, then you're talking about a place that exists outside of our realm of existence. So, again, if all these puzzle pieces are on the playing board, then I haven't gone out of bounds yet, y'all. Even, it, like, you can poke holes. I'm not saying, like Christian said about the rogue wave thing, I'm not saying that my stance is bulletproof. I'm just saying I'm coming strong and I'm coming hard, and you're going to have to come strong and come hard to legitimately, and I'm saying legitimately, say, nope, can't, impossibility. Just like with Christians, I would need to come hard and come strong to say, nope, impossibility. I can't do it, so I won't.
As we've said several times before, like, we like to have our little boxes. We like to say that this is exactly how things work. because that makes me feel comfortable. The more my boxes make sense to me. But unfortunately for that mindset, the reality exists. And there are simply things that, as much as we attempt to classify, we just haven't done enough work, or we're not at the point where we can understand, that make us go, oh, that makes me feel a little, I don't know, and upset. And then we disregard. And that is to our detriment. So do I think that that's what happened? Any supernatural, paranormal, extra-dimensional thing happened to the Mary Celeste? No. Could it have been what happened? Absolutely, yes. Once again, we weren't there, so we can say almost anything and not say something stupid. I mean, we've noted some things that are stupid while bringing up speculation here, but yeah, just give it an open thought, think about it a little more, and perhaps make your own conclusions, because you don't know either.
Exactly, and that's why we said about don't color outside the lines. Don't go making stuff up. There's no need to just start throwing facts out there and being like, oh, it stayed on course, oh, all this stuff, because you don't need to in order to get to the Tootsie Roll center of the Tootsie Pop. Like, it's still weird. There's still a lot going on. There's still a lot of strangeness that takes place in all of it, even if it's like, I would go as far as to say it still fits what's on the marquee if everybody's in exactly the right position for a rogue wave to take them out. Impossible? No, absolutely not impossible. That's sad. You have stepped right into the bar, looked probability dead in the eye, and told them exactly where they can shove it. If you have everybody in the right spot exactly at the right time and a wave takes them out. But again, yes, like Christian said, do I think that that's happened? That that's what happened? No, but I can't say no to it.
It's where I land. If I have to land. Nope.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like you said, like, I'll take a page out of your book. I'm not taking a bullet for it. Like, I'm not like this isn't one I'm standing 10 toes down on, because none of us really can.
Yeah. See, we get into some pop culture. I forgot to do this last time. But you know, the Mary Celeste obviously has mass appeal. And one of the reasons for its mass appeal, besides the earlier newspaper reporting, is a man you may know by the name of Arthur Conan Doyle. Now, at this point in his life, this is about 12 years after the Mary Celeste incident happened, he wrote a short story before he did anything with Holmes called J. Habakkuk Jephson's Statement. Now, one of the reasons, Joe, that it took me as long as it did to get the outline to you is because I read this and I had to pause multiple times over in this story. So what Conan Doyle did is he was just making it up. Like, he was trying to tell a story, trying to make money. It's what you do. He wasn't trying to make a thing that said this is definitively what happened. And some people reported it as if it were true, and he was very flabbergasted by that. So that's not his fault. That is other people. But what happened is that he, either for copyright reasons or to not get sued, or maybe because he forgot how it was spelled, called the ship the Marie Celeste, not the Mary Celeste, the Marie Celeste. And that was something that traveled through other people, and they misnamed the ship for decades. It is only more recently we've kind of like regained the original spelling in the public consciousness. So we get a lot of popularized false ideas. Once again, the name of the ship being different, the ship being completely unharmed. They're showing no signs of anything bad happening, comes from the short story. And the lifeboats are still there in the story. Real life, lifeboat gone. Short story, lifeboat still being there. Right. It also contains the very casual racism of the day when this was written. It is, remember when things are written in the period of time that they were in, the way people thought, this is part of it. So I believe the original crew, there were no Africans of any sort, American or not, on the original crew of the story. He adds them on. They mutiny against their white leaders. We have the magical Negro trope early on in the story with like an older black woman who like gives him, the main character, an amulet to like bring him to the point where he's saved by some Africans. He is then revered because he has this kind of like artifact on his person, which brings into very terrible cultural depictions there. And he is praised and hated by different Africans for his whiteness. And eventually he's able to tell his story. Think about that before we move on.
No, I let you, you took the bullet for that one. I knew about all that. I knew. And for anybody who wants to throw a flag on the play because of some of the language that was used, look it up. It's an actual term. Like, it's a term for an actual trope in writing, unfortunately. But yeah, no, there's nothing more to be said. It's garbage.
Yeah. It was a young man writing in the period of time that he was in. Whether he actually thought those things, probably. Don't know. I'm not going to throw anything out there in regards to Doo. Next up, we have, there are two radio plays. The one that I actually wanted to mention happened in the 30s, was done by Hammer Film back in the day. So, you know, Joe and I, big Hammer guys. The Mystery of the Mary Celeste, we had voice work done by Bela Lugosi. I was not able to look into this one, but it sounds fascinating at the very least. Then we have,
I saw it listed on some of the materials. It's one that I'm actually going to go try to find after the fact.
Yeah. Then of course we have Doctor Who in a first Doctor story, The Chase. We have time traveling Daleks who end up on the Mary Celeste, and the crew is so afraid that they just abandon ship, which, to be fair, as goofy as they look to a modern audience with the plungers and all, and I love my Daleks for what they are. Seeing that in 1872, I'd abandon ship too. I don't even know if I'd take the lifeboat. Like, yeah. Then, of course, as I mentioned earlier in the show, my introduction was The Real Adventures of Johnny Quest, where we see in a flashback the ship being surrounded by a beam of light from an unknown source, the crew taken, but the ship left behind. As they go into the future, the present, we see something similar happen to someone else. You know, the implication being aliens, some other being that aren't shown on screen, so we're kind of left with more questions than answers. You know, my favorite thing in the world. So, final judgments, Joe, take it away for you.
Yeah, I've got to chuck it up to the supernatural on this one.
Okay. Yeah. Once again, I'm taking the rogue wave hypothesis, maybe the water spout, maybe the storm, and it maybe freaked them out enough to where they thought, oh no, the ship's going to go down, and they didn't actually check for damage or anything, and the lifeboat's fine, so we're going to go on there, and they drifted off the sea, didn't have provisions, and died, because they were just in that much of a panic. I don't want that to be true, because that's quite horrific to go through those circumstances, but so that's where we are. What do you guys think? Do you have any idea what happened to the Mary Celeste? Is there something that we forgot to do? Was it really death by a mutinous crew? Were there extra normal abductions in some way, shape, or form? Something else? But we didn't touch on everything. The history and folklore have on a subject tonight. So let us know in the comments below if there's something you'd like us to do a follow-up on. As well, we will be moving next month into our next category, true crime, which we haven't finalized yet on. I'll probably give Joe a couple of ideas that we'll decide when we go into May, and hopefully we actually record in May, but you know, life is what it is. We'll figure something out. So Joe, anything you want to leave before we head out?
Just approach this one with an open mind. This is a great example of a story that embraces folklore, embraces mythology, and is best suited for folks that are willing to embrace the unknown.
All right. Stay spooky out there, people. See you next time.